I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Tuesday, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie outlined his $32.9 billion budget proposal in an address before a joint session of the legislature. Even though he has been a critic of the Affordable Care Act, Christie did agree to accept money from the federal government to expand Medicaid eligibility. He's also given online gambling the green light in Atlantic City. While Governor Christie was not invited to the annual conference of the Conservative Political Action Committee, or CPAC, he is enjoying the support of most of his state, which went for President Obama in a big way last November. We asked Charles Style to join us. He's the political columnist for The Record. He writes the Political Style column and contributes to NorthJersey.com's The Source, and that's a political news blog. And Charles Style, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. My pleasure.
And just how popular is Governor Christie in New Jersey?
Well, he's not as popular as Springsteen at the moment. I think Springsteen's far more sustainable, and Christie's far more, you know, politicians have these brief moments in the sun, and right now he's at that rare level, and he seems to be holding pretty good at the moment. Even he would be surprised at that, because I think the governor himself said that he pretty much predicted that his numbers were going to come down. It was inevitable with the state budget.
Sure.
And the rigors of an upcoming campaign, but they're up there.
Well, up there, I think, in the 70s, right, Charlie?
That's correct, yes. And they've stayed there. You would think there'd be a little, you know, reasonable deflating down into the 60s at this point, but he's holding pretty firm. Mm-hmm.
Is that, do you think, in part his response to Hurricane Sandy?
Oh, I think it still is. I think he still commands that impression, and I think he, and I think it's just reflective of his style. A lot of people tend to forget that prior to Sandy, his numbers were in the comfortable low to mid 50s, which is a pretty good marker. And I think a lot of it is attributed to his kind of go on the offensive, combative style. I think that really strikes a chord with voters. I also think those numbers were sustained by his attack on House Speaker John Boehner and the House Republicans, his own party, for dragging their feet on Sandy aid. I think he got a lot of bonus points for that, and I think it's in a lot of ways is an extension of the same sentiment that was uncorked by his embrace of President Obama. A lot of people are tired of gridlock. They're tired of partisan games, and they find somebody who steps in and tries to break through that as refreshing, and does it in a way that's distills their anger about it. So I think that's really what's working for him.
And we should remind our listeners he's a Republican in a very, very blue state.
Yes, Democrat. This is a Democratic state. It has 700,000 more registered Democrats than Republicans. I think it was not since George Bush Sr. did the state of New Jersey support a Republican presidential candidate back in 1988. So, yeah, by and large, I mean, there is a good vein of Republicanism in New Jersey, and I think that gets overlooked, but by and large, it's a Democratic state.
And we should say, and let me give out the phone number, because I do want to hear from our New Jersey listeners, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Charlie, going back to the budget proposal, $32.9 billion, it's about a 4% increase over last year's budget. Does that tell us that New Jersey's doing better?
Telling us that it's a more modest and responsible forecast of where the state is going. I think this budget, in a lot of ways, is a more responsible document and kind of masking the irresponsible document of the year before. I mean, it's responsible because, well, you know, he's funding the statutory payment of $1.7 billion for the pension funds, which is really, if you look at the context of how the pension fund has been raided and ignored for public employees over the past 15 years, that is actually a remarkable number, and he deserves credit for that. And I think that's good. But I think what this budget also reflects is that it's been cobbled together because of the kind of the phony revenue numbers that he used to prop up last year's budget. Governor wanted a across-the-board income tax increase, and he justified that by saying revenues would climb by 7.3%, which was almost like a boom time kind of surge in revenues. Nobody believed it. And as this budget reflects, it's pretty much a concession that his critics were right. He just doesn't have enough money. He had to delay in this budget. He's delaying a property tax rebate into August just to cover the shortfall. And there is no tax cut for, you know, he's not advancing another tax cut in this budget. So, and he's had to take money from clean energy funds to help meet the constitutional requirement to balance the budget. So, it's more sober, more realistic, but than last year. But it's forced to be that way because of the, I would say, the recklessness of last year's budget.
Well, and interestingly, he did accept the Medicaid funding portion of the Affordable Care Act. He will accept federal aid to cover, I'm not sure how many residents in New Jersey, but those that would qualify for Medicaid.
That's correct. He the range, the estimates are anywhere from 227,000 newly eligible Medicaid residents to about 300,000.
Wow.
And this does not have a direct impact on the budget. It's more of a kind of a, has the potential of a kind of a stimulus effect. A stimulus effect within a limited range of the healthcare industry. There's more federal dollars pouring in, and that means more patients being covered, going to doctors, and doctors' offices, and clinics. And there'll be probably some need for new equipment, new staffing, and the like. So that certainly is a plus. And it was, as a lot of Democrats said, it was a no-brainer for him to accept on a fiscal level, because it does. Well, it does. It may have. It may reduce the state's. Might provide anywhere from $125 to $227 million in savings for the budget. So I stand corrected on that. I forgot about that small piece of it. But that's. It was a very good, it was an offer he couldn't refuse, and the only thing that held him back were long-term political considerations.
Well, but he has lobbied against the Affordable Care Act, I shouldn't say lobby,
That's
but
right.
He has criticized it. He called it wrong for New Jersey, wrong
right.
for America. But do you think it was just sort of practical consideration? And he's one of a handful of Republican governors who have decided to go with this.
I think you're right. I think he became the eighth Republican governor to accept it. But if you look at that lineup of other Republican governors, I mean, Rick Scott in Florida last week agreed to accept the Medicaid aid. And here's a guy who is harshly critical of Obamacare, as they call it. And in fact, he was a Tea Party-blessed governor, but he really had no choice. That was for the same practical reasons I outlined before. Plus, he's very unpopular, and is in jeopardy of losing re-election down there. So, but you have the governor of Arizona, a very conservative governor. You have John Kasich, Ohio. So, I think those governors have given him cover in a sense. So if he does run for president in 2016, it's probably going to be an issue in some of the those precincts and some of the more conservative states that he embraced Obamacare. But I think there's these, with the help of these other governors, I think this kind of neutralized the issue, or at least taken some of the edge off it.
Plus,
he had no practice. I mean, as a governor of the state of New Jersey, it would have been. There really is no logic not to accept that money.
And just a couple more minutes before we have to say goodbye to you. Interestingly, he did sign online gambling for Atlantic City. Is this to help resuscitate Atlantic City? I know some of the casinos in Pennsylvania have in a sense, prevented or stolen customers from Atlantic City.
Oh, absolutely. I think this is a survival tactic. Atlantic City's revenues keep plummeting, and that the competition, that, you know, Atlantic City, I think the state has slowly and grudgingly come to terms with the fact that that it is not this isolated little island of gambling on the East Coast anymore. It doesn't monopolize it. But I think the state, frankly, has been slow to realize it and slow to act. I think they've realized it. They've been very slow to act on it. And now they're embracing things that they wouldn't consider, 10 years ago.
You had mentioned, I almost hate to talk about 2016 because it's only 2013, but nonetheless, it is interesting that Chris Christie not invited to CPAC, and much has been made about that during the week. What do you make of that, I guess, not disinvite, but uninvite?
Well, I think it reflects some of the lingering anger over his embrace of President Obama. A week before the election and right at the day after or day or two after Hurricane or Superstorm Sandy. I think there is just a lot of conservative resentment. They feel that he helped Obama seal the election with that. And so I think that does reflect some of that. And I think it didn't help his standing with conservatives wasn't improved by his attack on Boehner. But that said, I think Christie is really banking on the party moving back to the center. I think he believes that if he's going to run and he's going to succeed, it's because the public and the Republican Party will be looking for somebody that's more pragmatic, who can accomplish things, and who can stand above some of the partisan warfare. And, he's a guy who can be partisan when it suits him, but can be bipartisan when it benefits him. And I think a lot of people are looking for that kind of mix, and I think that's how he's betting that that's going to be a winning formula for him in 2016. So I'm not so sure that a temporary fit of pique by CPAC, who invited, let's face it, losers like Sarah Palin, to speak, it really worries him that much.
Final question, about 30 seconds here. Cory Booker, I guess the other rising star in New Jersey, running for the Senate?
Yes, he is. It's pretty clear it's been clear for some time. All you have to do is ask Frank Lautenberg. It's been clear Frank Lautenberg resented his almost drooling for the job. So, he is the front runner, although I think he went from being the anointed one to downgraded to front runner. I think he's going to face a more a difficult challenge than they realize at this point. I think Frank Pallone, the congressman,
I got to jump in here.
Give him a run.
Okay, Charles Stahl, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, political columnist for The Record. Stay with us. We'll be talking about Pennsylvania after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Fleischer Art Memorial proudly supports WHYY and has a 115-year tradition of providing art classes for thousands of children and adults throughout the Delaware Valley. There are workshops in drawing, painting, sculpting, and more, taught by Fleischer's noted faculty. The Fleischer Art Memorial spring term begins April 6th and offers more than 60 art workshops. Registration and more information is available online at fleischer.org.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on America Abroad, how will religious minorities in the Middle East fare in an era of revolution after the rise of Islamist governments? Religious minorities in the Middle East, next time on America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 11 on WHYY.
Discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY over the last 5 years have offset government losses and resulted in the growth of our services. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org and make a donation. Thank you very much.
I'm Marty Moscoane. This is Radio Times. While New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett are both Republicans, their styles could not be more different. Christie is a recognized political figure with national ambitions, while Corbett maintains a low profile even in the state. Governor Corbett has outlined his budget proposal for the next fiscal year, has said he wants to get the government out of the liquor sales business. He's called for privatizing the state lottery and has filed suit against the NCAA for sanctioning Penn State for its handling of the Sandusky child sex abuse scandal. Joining us now is John Baer. He's political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. His blog, Baer Growls, can be found at philly.com, and his new memoir, On the Front Lines of Pennsylvania Politics, published last year. And John Baer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us, I was going to say another John, but that doesn't sound quite right, is John Micek, editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and for Penn Live. And John Micek, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hey, Marty.
John Baer, let me begin with you. We were just talking about New Jersey's very popular governor, Chris Christie. How do Pennsylvanians feel about their governor, Tom Corbett?
Well, if they're like me, they wish we could trade.
I mean, really?
From a journalistic standpoint, I would love for Chris Christie to be a Pennsylvanian. A lot more fun to cover, obviously, potential for magic at any moment. And, you know, the polling, kind of the public polling, nonpartisan public polling in Pennsylvania kind of speaks for itself. The governor's approval ratings have gone from 36% in a Quinnipiac poll down to 26% in a Franklin and Marshall University poll. So at the moment, as Governor Christie rides high in Jersey, Governor Corbett not so much in Pennsylvania.
John Micek, do you think it's policies, personality, or some combination of the two?
I think it's a lot of it, or both of it rather. You know, the governor came in to an admittedly sort of dire fiscal picture, and his priority was to cut programs. As soon as you begin cutting programs that people like, schools, public welfare, you know, state parks, stuff that's, you know, the kind of shiny face of state government, that's going to get you into trouble early on. I mean, the other issue is that when he had a very rocky first couple of months coming in as an attorney general who didn't really understand the rhythms of Harrisburg, who was more sort of imperial than a lot of people were used to, you know, it created sort of this, you know, Iceman image of him, or, you know, in the case of my friend Mr. Baer's newspaper, the Tin Man, the guy without a heart. Whether that's fair or not is a matter of debate, but that's the image he's now been stuck with.
And I wonder, John Baer, about even the Republicans in the legislature, how they feel about their governor, or our governor, I should say, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of kind of inside backroom stuff now, but, I mean, it could be problematic. The governor has not the sort, he didn't come to office, as Micek points out, with sort of as much a political background as an administrative background. It's very different being a prosecutor, although Chris Christie certainly made the transition, than running a state. And to run a state, you need to be able to get along with the legislature. A number of Republican legislators have more than once publicly and frequently privately complained about the fact that there doesn't seem to be much cooperation, there doesn't seem to be much heads up. The governor decides what he's going to do, much like you would do in preparing a criminal case, and then you announce the results or the indictments. And in this case, it hasn't helped him. And the danger, Marty, is the longer it goes on, the deeper the hole gets, and the harder it'll be to climb out of it.
Well, I wonder too, John Micek, this goes back to when Corbett was attorney general, but he also indicted a number of members of the legislature as well. And I've always wondered whether that made them fear him or whether that has in any way complicated the relationship.
That'll make things awkward, huh?
I would think so.
The first thing, before you even get elected, you begin arresting members of the institution that you have to work with, might have to work with in the future. Governor Corbett's always had better relations with House Republicans, with whom he is sort of more ideologically simpatico. It was a lot more icy with the state Senate Republicans for an awfully long time, although that has thawed somewhat. But yeah, there's nothing that sort of like set the wrong tone by, you know, going out on the campaign trail and announcing that the institution that you have to work with is corrupt and broken and bragging about how you've arrested all of them. That got him into trouble early on. Although, I mean, there is now some evidence, though, Marty, that maybe the governor's figuring out this whole retail politics thing. He's been out shopping his budget proposals. He's going to be in Erie this afternoon to talk about the liquor privatization plan. That's something they didn't really do with the first budget. They thought they could just sort of go out there and say, here's my plan, like it, and then not have to sell it. Clearly, they've learned that lesson, and the governor has been a lot more visible this budget cycle than he's been in the past.
Well, in fact, he was in Philadelphia yesterday doing some of what you just said there, John Micek. To you, John Baer, only because we were talking with Charlie Style about Chris Christie, who decided, even though he has been a pretty outspoken critic of the Affordable Care Act, that he was going to accept federal money to expand Medicaid. Governor Corbett has said no. Is there any pressure on Corbett to change his mind, or is he going to stick to his guns?
Well, I think there's probably a tremendous amount of political pressure to change his mind, and it could well become a political chip for two reasons. As you watch even conservative governors like Jane Brewer in Arizona start, you know, make the switch and go along with the president, Florida Governor Scott the same way, people are going to say, look, what's wrong with this guy? Everybody else is accepting the fact that the program both extends health care to more people and gives the states more money for a lot of years. The other thing, Marty, that could become problematic for him is that Alison Schwartz, who is almost certainly going to run against him, one of her strong points is health care. Mm-hmm. She would hammer this through a campaign, assuming she were the nominee. But he left the door open. I mean, he was immediately tagged as bailing out of the expansion, but what he said was, for now.
Wow.
So the door is open. He can at any time say, look, I've now talked with Health and Human Services Secretary Sebelius. We've worked out some waivers. We've worked out some details, and now I understand, and now I can accept it. So there's some wiggle room there.
John Micek, let me ask you about, I guess, the new sheriff in town. That would be the Attorney General Kathleen Kane. She's been on the job for a couple of months. How much has she, not ruffled feathers, but made waves?
Ruffled feathers, made waves, annoyed. Fill in your favorite adjective here. She one of the first things Mrs. Kane was tasked with was doing a review of the administration's proposed privatization contract with Camelot Global Services to run the Pennsylvania Lottery. She got up there and declared it unconstitutional. The administration is now scrambling to figure out what to do next. They had asked Camelot for an extension on the bid deadline, so the whole thing didn't go belly up. But, I mean, that deal is now in trouble. She's launched a probe and appointed a special prosecutor to look at Governor Corbett's handling of the Sandusky case at Penn State while he was Attorney General. This is ironic for a woman who said she wasn't going to be an activist Attorney General on the campaign trail. She's looking a whole lot like an activist Attorney General right now.
John Baer, unconstitutional on what grounds is she saying?
Well, she basically went along with what the Democratic legislative leadership claimed at the time the lottery deal was announced, which was that any expansion or extension of gambling in Pennsylvania lies within the purview of the legislature and not the executive. And so she kind of buys into that and says, look, the Constitution provides for legislative action on this, not executive order, so go back to the drawing board. The problem here is the same problem that Corbett has had in a lot of other areas. Had he gone to the legislature a year ago, and even though they claim they did, I mean, they really didn't make an effort and say, look, I think this in the long term is a better deal for Pennsylvania. Will you work with me to make this happen? Maybe this could have been done, and it could have been a feather in his cap. Now it's just another annoyance, another expense, another issue that he's delayed on, and thanks to the Attorney General, looks like he's wrong.
Let me quickly reintroduce you, and that's John Baer, political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. Also with us, John Micek, editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News, and both of them joining us today on Radio Times as we all get up to speed on some of the news and political news and updates and developments here in Pennsylvania. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Tony from Souderton to join us. And Tony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm calling today because I actually lost my grandma to a 23-year-old drunk driver.
Oh, dear.
And I watched Corbett unveil his plan. Now, he cited South Carolina four times, as a model for his plan. And I don't even think he knows that South Carolina has the highest rate of fatalities for drunk drivers. You know, does he even look into the social costs of these programs, or is he just trying to make his friends rich and get us all drunk? I really regret voting for this guy.
Well, Tony, first of all, I'm really sorry what happened to your grandmother. And if it's a bit of an awkward segue, but nonetheless, let me put this to you, John Baer, about, and Governor Corbett is not the first governor who's been trying to privatize liquor sales in Pennsylvania. What is his argument, I guess, to do that?
Well, his argument is the same as been made by Governor Thornburgh and after him, Governor Ridge, is that it's not a core function of government. It's not something government ought to be doing. There's only one other state in America that does, and that's the ultra-progressive state of Utah. But the caller's point is a point that always comes up during this debate. Mothers Against Drunk Driving always argue against it. A lot of social activists argue against it, that it would increase consumption of alcohol, increase alcoholism, increase traffic fatalities, and there certainly is that risk. It's just common sense. If you make booze more accessible, presumably more people would buy it and use it here. And so that debate is the same debate that has gone on since the 70s and will go on again.
Do you want to add to that, John Mysak? And Governor Corbett, by, I guess, privatizing, wanting to make it so that you could buy certain kinds of, I guess, liquor or beer or wine or whatever in supermarkets, things like that?
Yeah, I mean, the administration has tried to position this debate as one of consumer choice, that rather than having to go to a beer distributor to buy your beer, you can go to your local Wegmans or Whole Foods or whatever and get your wine and liquor and spirits potentially in the same place. They're positioning that way, and John is right. Underlying that is the governor's sort of core belief that this isn't something that government should be doing. I mean, he points out that on the one hand, the state is in the business of taking out display ads in newspapers encouraging people to buy vodka, but on the other hand, also engaging in education programs about the dangers of overconsumption and also in enforcement actions. So he finds that to be a fundamental conflict of interest.
It feels like a conflict of interest to me, John Baer.
Well, yeah, sure it is. I mean, you have a monopoly. You have a state liquor system that bottles and sells its own wine at the same time it's trying to control the sale of wine. You have a monopoly within a monopoly. They're the only ones selling, and so they're selling and pushing their own products. It makes no sense. It's schizophrenic to, as Mysak notes, on the one hand, use tax dollars to pay for programs to deal with drug abuse and alcoholism, and on the other hand, use tax dollars to sell alcohol. So, look, there's a lot of arguments on a lot of sides of it. The common sense argument says it's nothing the state should be doing.
The state, though, does make money, right, John?
Sure, it makes money. Argument would be it could make as much or more over time in a private sector through the sale of licenses, through the taxing, increased consumption, and so on. But it's a long-standing argument, a very difficult political argument. I'd love to hear Mysak's view on this. I would be very surprised if he gets a full privatization. I think there's a possibility to get something. Full privatization, I don't think is going to happen.
And John Mysak, what I hear are efforts to, if not privatize, at least modernize the sale of spirits in the state.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you ask the LCB, they'll tell you as they fight for their own survival that's precisely what they've been trying to do, is make the state agency behave more like a business, to which the critics say, well, why don't we have business behave more like a business and off with you? I agree with John. I'd be shocked if we got full privatization. I mean, what you might end up with is sort of like half a loaf where you get wine and beer on sale in grocery stores, and then maybe some flexibility for beer distributors to sell different increments of beer, which is one thing they've been after for a long time, in 6-packs and 12-packs, which they can't do now. You can only go into a beer distributor and buy it by the case. So that might end up being sort of the package we're left with at the end of this.
You are forgiven.
And Marty, if I can just add one thing. This is one of those issues where supporters constantly point to statewide polls that show that consumers overwhelmingly support a privatization system. But what gets missed in that is the prioritization of issues. I mean, if you asked voters blank out what are the top priorities for the government of Pennsylvania to be dealing with, I doubt, well, in fact, I know the control of liquor would not be on the top of the priorities. There are a ton of other problems. It's an inconvenience. It's not a must-have kind of issue. And look, I mean, the state has made improvements. Go down on Girard Avenue in Philly. There's a liquor store down there that's the size and quality of Total Wines. Not that I've ever been into Total Wines. But, you know, you can see they have made some efforts and they've made the improvements. It's just one of those issues that, yeah, common sense, people say, sure, we shouldn't be in the business. But is it a life-altering experience for people? Is it something that's on the top of the priority list? No, it isn't.
Let me take one more call about liquor privatization. We have Sean from, looks like, Lansdale joining us. And, Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My concern is with the beer distributors on the privatization bill. It seems like it's given an advantage to the big box retailers, and you know that's going to flood the market and put these small guys out of business. And I was just wondering if that's the only reason that the beer distributors are opposing this bill.
Sean, are you one of the small guys?
No, but I have a family member that's one of the small guys.
Let me give John Micek a chance to respond to that. John?
Well, I mean, the caller has hit the argument on the head here. There is some concern among the beer distributor industry that if this happens, that's exactly what's going to happen, that they're going to be put out of business. The counter argument coming from proponents of this is, well, if the state goes to full privatization, then distributors can compete for one of the available 1,200 some odd licenses that are supposed to be created and expand their business to include wine and spirits as well, therefore making them more economically competitive. They don't see it that way.
Sean, thanks for the call to Radio Times. John Baird, just one more question about liquor sales in Pennsylvania, and then we're going to take a break and then talk about some other things. But just how strong is the union on this issue?
Union is very strong, always has been. I mean, people talk about how unions generally have lost their power, witness Wisconsin. But in Pennsylvania, it's a different kind of state. There's been a long, proud tradition of union activism in this state, and they've been very successful so far, even in this climate. I thought Corbett coming in had the best shot of any governor to turn this issue around to the Republican conservative point of view. But I think he's kind of let that slide, and as I said earlier, I'd be shocked if he got it.
But do you think it's something about the state or the way the union is run or just how people interact with employees at the state stores?
Yes, I do. I think it's all of that. I think the state is averse to change generally. I think the unions have been very effective generally, and as I said earlier, I just don't think it's an issue that the general public is advocating for. They support it, of course, but they're not out there beating down the doors.
And that's John Baer, who has described Pennsylvania as the land of low expectations. He's a political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. John Micek with us as well, editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and for Penn Live. We are talking about Pennsylvania politics, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, BigBlueMarbleBooks.com.
Germantown Friends School Craft Show supports WHYY, bringing woodworkers, glassblowers, fiber artists, jewelers, weavers, ceramicists, and other fine artisans from around the nation to Philadelphia. The 29th annual GFS Juried Craft Show takes place March 1st through 3rd, Friday evening through Sunday afternoon at Germantown Friends School. Cafe opens Saturday and Sunday, serving sweet and savory treats. For details, 215-900-7734 or germantownfriends.org/craftshow.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll fact-check the sequester. What will these automatic spending cuts mean for air travel, the military, food inspection? And speaking of food, foodie Mark Bittman on loving the Mediterranean diet. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY. Supporting WHYY, transforminghealth.org, an interactive online resource offering a comprehensive look at the changing landscape of healthcare in America and right here in Pennsylvania. Videos, blogs, and success stories are available at transforminghealth.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're getting an update on Pennsylvania politics from John Micek and John Baer, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about Penn State's efforts to change the Electoral College and its impact on presidential elections and also voter ID. But let me first get Mildred from Philadelphia to join us. And Mildred, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
You're talking to a person who's 81 years old. I'm a state employee, retired. I'm a Democrat, and I'm so opposed to what Corbett is doing, and maybe his wife should be moving out of the home because I don't think either one of them were.
Wait. Mildred, hold on.
Okay. No. Go ahead.
Let me ask you a question. What is your major critique?
My major critique is that not only Corbett, but every other Republican is losing jobs in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I remember when we had industry here and we were able to put people to work. And we can't do that anymore because our jobs and everything are being shipped out.
Well, the question is whether Governor Corbett is responsible for that or not, Mildred. But let me give John Micek a chance to respond. And, you know, we've had a couple of, I would say, upset, even angry callers into the show, which is interesting.
The governor rather tends to have that effect on people. And, you know, retirees particularly will take, a more jaundiced view. I mean, we haven't talked about it, but,
no.
You know, the governor is eyeing changes to the state's pension system as well. You know, that's a hearth and home and pocketbook issue that hits a lot of state employees where they live. So it's sort of understandable that the caller felt that way.
To you, though, John Baer, and even picking up on this pension issue, and this has hung over a number of governors, can you speak to that?
Yeah, on the one hand, Corbett deserves credit for at least attacking the problem. Prior governors have basically kicked it down the road. On the other hand, in this climate, and given the political difficulty he faces, the fact that he has been portrayed fairly or not as sort of cold-hearted conservative, it too is a very difficult issue. He is not seeking to make any changes to current retirees. Nothing would change there. He is talking about changing the way the pension formula is constructed for current employees and enrolling them in sort of an IRA kind of retirement system rather than the current system. This is, much like the federal government, this is a problem that was created by past legislators and past governors. They're the ones responsible for it. They're the ones that have to fix it. It's coming home to roost during this governor's reign, and that's bad news for him, but at least he's making an attempt.
Mildred, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. John Baer, if I can go back to you, where does the voter ID law stand?
It remains a mess, like most things in the state. It faces, it's going to trial in mid-July. The whole issue is going to trial. It is suspended for the primary. I can't imagine it will be in effect for the municipal elections and judicial elections in the fall. Because if it goes to trial in July, that's going to be a while. Then whatever happens there is going to be appealed. And then it's going to end up in the Supreme Court. And, you know, it's one of those issues, Marty, that cost taxpayers in more ways than one. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've already spent over $200,000 in taxpayer money for outside counsel, because anytime there's a real problem with government, the thousands of lawyers that are employed by government aren't good enough, so they go and hire outside specialty counsel. So, I mean, that's where we are. Voter ID is not, it's on the books, but it's not enforced. I don't think it'll be enforced for a while, if ever.
Well, John Micek, what's interesting is Kathleen Kane, the new attorney general, when she was running for office, she criticized the voter ID law. Is this going to be a challenge for her and her office?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the Attorney General's office that's charged with defending the law. But then this week, there was a story that came out. Ms. Kane is considering her options on this because, you know, as a candidate, she'd come out and say it's unconstitutional. So she's sort of in an interesting place where you come out and you're a candidate, you're in opposition to something, and then later on you're elected to the job and you might have to defend it. It might be one of these things where she goes the path of the Obama Justice Department and kind of just lets it drop. It'd be very interesting to see.
Oh, listen, Ron. It's an interesting scenario. Can you do that?
Her office is charged with defending the law in the state, but
well, there is. If I can,
theoretically possible. Let me, John, can jump in here on this.
Go ahead, John.
I could add just a little thing. She does have an out. There is something called the Commonwealth Attorneys Act that allows the Attorney General to pass up defending a law that the legislature has passed, and kick it over to the Office of General Counsel, which is the governor's personal attorney, personal in the sense of the office's attorney. Mm. Remember, the Attorney General represents the state of Pennsylvania, but the Office of General Counsel represents the incumbent governor. And under the Commonwealth Attorneys Act, she could say, look, I've already commented on this. I don't want to cloud the water. I don't believe in this law. It's your law. You take it.
Well, let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have Pete from, looks like Norristown joining us. And Pete, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
To his credit, Governor Corbett, when he came into office, had a blue ribbon panel who made some very good recommendations for transportation infrastructure in the state to generate $3.5 billion a year. The governor's recently proposed a very anemic $500 million, I think, for the first year of funding through some raises in the wholesale gas tax. I know Senator Rafferty and many Republicans in the legislature are very unhappy with this. They're promoting a much more aggressive program. Democrats are threatening not to vote for this anemic proposal by the governor unless it really addresses transportation. And this means thousands of jobs for people in the Commonwealth, and it also is a huge investment for private sector businesses. To me, it seems like a no-brainer that Corbett should support this strongly politically. Mm-hmm. Would help him, but for whatever reason he's clinging to this Rover Norquist philosophy. I'd like to hear your guest comments on the transportation bill. I'll take my comments off the air.
Pete, thanks for the call. You may have answered your own question there, but let me give John Micek a first crack at that. Go ahead, John.
Well, it's funny you should bring that up. We actually had the governor in for an editorial board meeting for Penn Live and the Patriot News the other week, and this very question came up, and he said he'd be willing to consider what lawmakers sent to him. So it seems like, you know, while there is this sort of resistance to direct tax increases on consumers and motorists, I mean, let's face it, uncapping the oil franchise tax, which is the main revenue raiser for this transportation funding package, is a tax increase. It is naive to assume that increase will not be passed on at the pump someplace, so motorists will feel the pinch on it. Whether or not the governor decides to go ahead with other fee increases or tax increases is another matter entirely. But when he came in, he did say that he wanted to see what lawmakers sent to him. And so we'll see what happens from there.
How beholden do you think he is, John Baer, to Grover Norquist?
Probably less and less as time goes by. Norquist has already said that his impact fee on Marcellus Shale is a tax. You know, I have written at least once and probably thought of it a lot more that what the governor can do to slip out of this is say, look, this infrastructure transportation problem with deficient bridges and dangerous highways is an issue of public safety. I'm far more interested in protecting the citizens of Pennsylvania than I am a pledge made to a man named Grover who doesn't live in the state. I mean, I think that's an easy out. As to Pete's call,
yes.
There's an interesting little political backdrop because everything comes back to politics. Senator John Rafferty, who's the chairman of the Transportation Committee in the Senate, has a little bit of a personal grudge with the governor. Rafferty wanted to run for attorney general, and Corbett backed an opponent in the Republican primary and forcing Rafferty out of the race. Those are kinds of things that politicians don't easily forget. So whatever the merit of the argument for putting more money into transportation, and I think Rafferty's perfectly right on this, but there is that little bit of a political backstage thing.
Well, that's fascinating. But, John, just to underscore what you said, we are talking about a state with many, not all, but certainly a lot of deficient bridges and roads in serious need of repair.
thousands of bridges, and it's one of those issues that isn't as evident in the eastern part of the state, where the major transportation issues are congestion and traffic and mass transit. But in the central and western part of the state, they are issues of livelihood. The roads and bridges support the commerce and the commuters throughout the rest of the state. They've been ignored for way too long because, again, our government just will not address problems that it faces. It addresses problems that it makes up.
And that's John Baer, who joins us along with John Micek. We are talking Pennsylvania politics, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John Micek, this gets us a little bit into the weeds, but it's important. Senate Majority Leader Dominic Pileggi has introduced legislation to award Electoral College votes proportionally, not winner take all. And I said this gets us a bit into the weeds. What's the significance of what he's proposing?
Well, if you talk to Democrats, it's Republicans feeling the pain of 20 years of the state going a deep presidential blue, trying to tilt the playing field in their favor. You know, the electoral tally, I don't have the specific numbers in front of me, but the electoral tally would have been a lot weaker for President Obama had these rules been in place last year. This is the senator's second run at this. He tried another plan back in 2011, got not only pushback from Democrats here, but also from national Republicans who were worried that this was going to erode Pennsylvania's status as a battleground state, and it's just more pain that they didn't need in a tough year for Mitt Romney. But he's coming back to it again. The senator has said this is not a top legislative priority for him, but this is something he would like to see done.
You think John Barrett's going to go anywhere?
I think it's a good example of addressing problems that you make up rather than problems that you have. Having said that, to his credit, Senator Pileggi has said he won't push this bill until after June 30th, the state budget annual deadline. But even making it an issue, putting it on the table, getting people to react to it, kind of takes the focus away from the things the legislature ought to be dealing with, first and foremost, transportation, secondly, pension. And you can go on down a whole litany of issues that ought to be dealt with. And this does smack of sort of sore loserism. Pennsylvania and a lot of other Republican-controlled states have been trying to change the playing field since President Obama was elected. And it just doesn't smell right. I mean, you know, we have rules. Let's all play by the rules. Don't try to change stuff because you haven't been winning.
To you, John Micek, and looking ahead over the next couple of months, do you think Governor Corbett's budget will pass pretty much as is, or is there going to be a lot of negotiating and jockeying over this budget?
And if you look at it, I mean, he's putting money back into some programs. There's more money for education. There's a bit more money in social welfare, particularly $20 million more to eliminate waiting lists for people with intellectual disabilities. That's an awful big thing within the State Department of Public Welfare. It looks like now state lawmakers are eyeing more money for the state-related universities after university leaders came in and made what seemed to be a fairly compelling argument about the student debt load. You know, there'll be the customary tweaking that happens with any budget proposal, but I don't think it'll be altered that dramatically. The one thing I'm sort of waiting for is the annual budget season surprise. We always seem to get that crops up, as John can attest. In like the last couple of days before the budget deadline last year, we all looked up and, you know, the governor said, "Hey, guess what? I'm going to give a $500 million tax credit to Royal Dutch Shell to build this big petrochemical processing plant in Western PA that no one had seen coming." During Governor Rendell's tenure, it was that $75 million tax credit for Hollywood. So for me, I'm sort of more interested in what ancillary issues are going to get sucked into this rather than sort of the actual spending plan, although that is hugely important.
John Baer, let me ask you about Penn State and the Sandusky scandal there. And as we know, Kathleen Kane has, I guess, opened an investigation into then-Attorney General Corbett's investigation into the scandal. Do you think there's some issues in there to be discovered?
Here's what I think on that. On the very narrow question of whether the Sandusky investigation was mishandled, I think ultimately what you end up with is a statement from Kane that says, "Look, this is not the way I would have handled it. This was a matter of prosecutorial discretion whether or not to use a grand jury, which can slow a process but keep it secret, or whether to make an arrest very early on, which can risk losing the case. It is very difficult for me to believe. I've known Tom Corbett since well before he was Attorney General. Remember, he was acting Attorney General under Governor Ridge. He comes from a prosecutorial background, has spent his career in prosecution. He always has been very active in child abuse cases. It is impossible for me to think that he would, for any reason, have jeopardized a prosecution against a potential child molester. I don't think there's going to be any smoking gun there. The problem he has is this image has been created that for political reasons, and everybody's always willing to believe the worst motivations in any politician, that he did do that. And so if there's a hint that he did that, he's doomed. But I don't think there will be. I think it'll just be a question of discretion. I wouldn't have done it this way. He did. I'm not saying he did anything wrong.
And John Micek, we're about 30 seconds away from the end of the show here, but can we assume that Governor Corbett will run for re-election, even though his numbers today at least are low?
That's a given. I mean, he's already said that he has no intent. While there's been no formal declaration, he says he has no intention of breaking the four-decade-old streak of governors seeking a second four-year term. So now we're just waiting for the formal announcement.
And who do you think will be challenging him, I guess, from the Democratic side? As you mentioned Alison Schwartz. Anyone else?
State Treasurer Rob McCord is a likely candidate. That's one name we've heard. John Hanger, the former DEP secretary under Governor Rendell, is an actual declared candidate. There are other names that have bobbled up, but it's sort of the upper tier of candidates at the moment.
Well, John Micek, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And John Baer, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be with you.
Nice to have you both with us. And John Baer, political columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, wrote a book last year on the front lines of Pennsylvania politics. John Micek, editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.